Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, AMD's new Ryzen 7 2700X and Ryzen 5 2600X, benchmarked and reviewed. Western Digital's Black and SanDisk Extreme Pro M.2 1TB NVMe drives are outstanding. Another new Nook from Intel, a 14TB hard drive, and quite a bit more, all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 462, recorded on April 19th, 2018. New AMD Ryzen CPUs reviewed.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Go to ring.com/twitch and get up to $150 off of a Ring of Security kit. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twit's weekly show that aims to bring you the hardware news, mobile, desktop, laptop, consoles, the Internet of Stuff, or enthusiasm. Actually, it occasionally wanes depending on the quality of the hardware. But the big news today, joining me right now to talk Ryzen 7 2700 and Ryzen 5 2600X, his review entitled Zen Matures, Mr. Ryan Shrout.
Well, I don't say it quite like that, but yeah, I guess that comes across. Yeah.
Really? Yeah, it's the next Zen.
Yeah, exactly. Essentially, it's this is one of those. So how do I say about this? It's actually a surprisingly good product. And I say surprisingly for a couple of reasons. One is, well, hold on. Wait for the detail.
One damn is faint if you praise.
Exactly. You know, AMD doesn't have a reputation for iterating on processor designs over the last decade, right?
Sure.
This launch is a success. It does that. It's not a revolutionary thing like we saw with the Ryzen 1000, but it is evolutionary on the vein that we have kind of seen over the years from Intel. And because of that, they're proving that they can execute on a roadmap and on a plan and all that type of stuff. And I do think it's important as you look at those specs, for example, that we understand that the 2000 series, this is not Ryzen 2, which I think we talked about last week as well. It's Ryzen 2000, which is the second generation of Ryzen, but it's essentially based on the same architecture. That's why you see Zen Plus there rather than Zen 2. So it does go from 14 nanometer to 12. You still have 8 cores and 16 threads on the flagship parts. Cache is still the same. You get a slight DDR memory speed increase. The prices are competitive. Go ahead.
It's an evolution, not a revolution.
Right. Right. Okay. It is a, you know, they've tweaked latencies in L1 cache, L2 cache, L3 cache, DDR memory, which by their own metrics come up to about a 3% IPC improvement clock for clock. Right.
Okay.
Which is modest. But you also take that into account if you look at the specs that the 2700X runs 200 to 300 megahertz faster than the 1800X at, you know, similar, you know, base boost clock speeds, right? So you are getting a jump in frequency along with that. You are paying a little bit more on the TDP side. It's 105 watts versus 95 watts. But in the grand scheme of things, for enthusiasts, DIY, gamers, that amount of difference isn't really going to change anything. The latency improvements that they did are kind of an interesting discussion. AMD was not interested in talking about how they were able to do this, right? I said, okay, how do you make these impressive numbers without changing the architecture in some kind of fundamental way? And they kind of said, you know, we're not really talking about it. These are just the numbers. And if you look at that, if you look at the graph down there, the next graph that we put up there, we did our own kind of like ping testing, which tests communication time between all these threads, which essentially allows you to test the memory subsystems of these processors. And there's a lot of lines there. What I will say is, remember that the Zen architecture, these parts are built into, they're designed with CCXs, core complexes. And each core complex has four cores and a block of L3 cache, and then they communicate to the other CCX through Infinity Fabric, right? So another four cores and another block of L3 cache. And what you'll see there is that the gray line to the green and yellow line on the left-hand side there, where the gray line is lower, it's actually the 1800X has better latencies inside the CCX. So think of those four cores talking to each other. If you look on the right-hand side, where that core is now talking to across the CCX, you'll see that the gray bar is higher, meaning that the new processors have better latency. They've improved the L3 latency, the complex to complex latency pretty dramatically, which is interesting. So you're basically gaining 10 nanoseconds there, and you're losing 5 nanoseconds on the bottom side. Now, clearly, what it appears like to me is that they had to do a trade-off, that the tweaks they had to make to get these improvements in the architecture were at the expense of, you know, some other portion. And by their determination, they said, okay, actually getting that 10 nanoseconds is more valuable than losing this 5 nanoseconds. It could be that maybe there's some threshold at 60 nanoseconds that as long as they're below that, they're safe or whatever it happens to be. I don't know. And again, nobody would explain it to me. So I'm just kind of guessing here based on our data. So that's kind of like the architectural change, but the net result is that performance goes up. And so it's hard to argue with that. They also launched the X470 chipset with this, which, to be quite frank, doesn't really have significant advantages over the X370. X470 motherboards will give you the capability to run StoreMI, which we'll talk about in a second. They will have slightly beefier power delivery systems integrated on them. And it also, these just have a year of learning that, you know, ASUS, MSI, Gigabyte have done. You know, after they developed the first Ryzen platforms, now they've had a year of education on what it is, user feedback, customer feedback, implementing it into new designs, essentially is what I would look at it for that. Because remember, these Ryzen 2000 series parts are backwards compatible to the X370 platform. As long as you've got the BIOS update for it, you'll be able to run those in there, which is a plus. Also a big plus, actually, which we would normally say, is stock coolers. All of these new Ryzen 2000 series come with a stock cooler. And the 2700X, the flagship part, comes with something they're calling the Wraith Prism, which is that guy right there. It's Prism because it's got LEDs in it, of course. But it's a pretty beefy heatsink. It's got, you know, six heat pipes, direct contact to the CPU heat spreader.
It's very robust for a stock cooler.
It is. You know what I mean? It's quiet.
We're used to seeing you can see the difference. Sort of the AMD cooler on the right there is kind of your standard, you know, we've seen it in so many Intel products and the AMD products. You know, it's a chunk of copper wrapped with aluminum. There's a fan. It's loud. It's miserable. But to actually see heat pipes and sort of a more sophisticated arrangement from a manufacturer is delightful and shocking.
It's you know, we compared it to a 240 millimeter air or water cooler, and it did, you know, it wasn't as good, but it was pretty close. It's quiet, it's easy to install, and it's included in the box, right? So that $329 MSRP includes that cooler. So, you know, the 8700K, for example, from Intel does not include a cooler.
Right.
So you have to buy at least a $30 cooler, upwards of a $50 cooler, depending on what you're looking for. In this case, you don't have to do that. There'll still be plenty of people that will do that. But I think AMD made the right decision in kind of, okay, we had some issues getting AM4 compatible coolers out into the market for these higher end flagship parts like the 1800X. Boom, now we've solved it and offered some value to the consumer along the way. So it's a pretty impressive shift. In terms of performance, here's what I will kind of summarize the performance. You can let me know if you have any other feedback on it. Is in single-threaded performance, the 2700X closes the gap, but the Intel part is still faster. If we're kind of just looking at the 2700X and the 8700K, these are the two, you know, most important parts in this discussion. And if you look at single-threaded results, Cinebench or Audacity, which is an interesting decision or comment. You'll find that, you know, Intel still has the advantage there. That didn't go away. Yes, you might get 200 or 300 megahertz of extra clock speed, but it's not closing the gap completely. And multi-threaded workloads, AMD extends its lead, where it had 8-core 16-thread going against 6-core 12-thread of the 8600K. That is still the case. And the AMD parts are still faster. Like if you're looking at your Cinebench multi-threaded scores right there. Gaming was the sore spot for the Ryzen 1000 series launch, if you remember, 1080p gaming specifically. And in this instance, again, they closed the gap. It's not gone. The 8700K in the purest sense of the word is still the fastest part for this, you know, 1080p gaming scenario in our testing. Mm-hmm. But the differences are a lot smaller. And you can see, you can compare the 2700X to the 1800X and see there are many places where it made some substantial improvements, right? Grand Theft Auto 5, for example, Assassin's Creed Origins, there were improvements, even in Total War Warhammer 2. There's a lot of jumps that occur. And I think, you know, I think we tested 8 or 9 games, one or two of them AMD is actually winning, the rest of them Intel's winning, but by smaller margins. And obviously we do have 1440p and 4K testing that show you that as you increase the resolution that you're gaming at, the differences provided by the different processors is obviously much more minimal. You know, so if you're gaming on an ultra wide, if you're gaming on a 25x14 display, the processor choice has significantly lower impact on what your total result is going to be. And go ahead.
I was going to say, so I'm not rushing out at this point to replace my beloved Ryzen 1800X.
No, I don't think so. And I don't think really AMD intends that to be the case. What I do find interesting is, because I've had this discussion with somebody about, like, what is the value of being able to have a socket-compatible processor from gen to gen? Because chances are the guy like you who bought an 1800X isn't going to go buy a 2700X to replace it with. You're getting a very marginal performance improvement. However, say you bought a Ryzen 5 1600, right? It's a 6-core part. Now you can upgrade to the 8-core part. It's pen compatible. You're getting extra frequency. You're getting a little bit extra capability. And you can do that without having to replace your motherboard. Maybe you had a Ryzen 5 1400. Maybe that was a Ryzen 3. I don't know. One of those quad-core parts, right? You can now double your core count on the same platform and you're good to go, right? So there are still some advantages there. No, this is not if you had a 1700, if you had an 1800, you probably don't want to go this way unless you just want the latest, best, neatest thing. But the ability, having the flexibility to do that without needing to replace your motherboard certainly is a welcome change to what we've been used to over the past many days, I guess, many years, I would say, not just days. And at $329, it's interesting. That's the price of the 2700X. That's the new flagship, current flagship for the Ryzen 2000 series. Remember that the 1800X launched at $499. So this is a $170 price drop in terms of new to new, and you're getting better performance because of it. It's pretty impressive when you look at it that way, right? So I came away pretty impressed, more than I thought it was going to be. I don't think that it doesn't win everything, right? It's not winning all these gaming benchmarks. They didn't suddenly flip the tables around on them there. But in the areas where they excelled, they increased that lead, right? So now the question will be, we'll talk about it later in the show, is Intel going to have to respond and release an 8-core part on their own, or, you know what? I don't know. It'll be interesting. And also, I would point out from Ken's review, he makes, if you look at the awards, a 2600X is the one that got the editor's choice, and the 2700X got the gold award. Editor's choice being a higher honor, I guess I would say, because it's $100 less than that. You still get an integrated cooler, which is high quality. It's not the Wraith Prism, but it's a good cooler. It's $100 less, 6-core 12-thread, and comparing it to the 8600K from Intel, it was a dominant winner. Right, because the 8600K is 6-core 6-threads, as opposed to this being 6-core 12-threads, and so it wins on, I think, in almost all of the games and in all of the other benchmarks as well by a significant margin. So, if you don't want to buy the highest end part, you can still pick up the 2600X for $229 with maybe an integrated value of a $30 or $40 cooler in it, you're paying $199 essentially for this part. It's going up against the $8,600K. So both of these solutions are really good. We also, we do have the 2700 and 2600. We'll probably do a follow-up at some point with those, although they're, you know, less interesting because of their, you know, lack of XFR and stuff like that, but they're going to be essentially in the same ballpark of performance.
When you say a significant performance delta, I mean, are we talking single digits, double digits?
You mean for the 2600X?
In terms of the gaming performance you mentioned. Yeah.
Oh, in terms of the gaming performance. For the 2700X, it's probably 5% is where I would average it out. If we're looking at, you know, 5% behind the 8700K, if we're looking at the 2600X versus the Intel 8600K, now you're looking at, even in the 1080p scores where, you know, it wins in Ashes, it's essentially tied in Ghost Recon, it's almost tied in GTA, which is one of the worst cases for it. But it wins, I would say, half to more than half. Yeah, about half of the benchmarks in the gaming side at 1080p. Mm-hmm. And then again, when you go to 25x14 or 4K, it doesn't even matter again. So depending on what you're going to pair it with in terms of graphics card and display, it's even more of an easy decision, I guess I would say, in that regard. So
there you have it.
Yeah.
So much excitement. I will say I'm pleased that I am not now weeping with a desperate need to save, you know, to move to a new processor to save additional time in rendering. Because that rendering delta between the 1800X and the 2700X was, you know, 27 seconds on a 330-second render. Yeah. I can live with that. So yeah. I was afraid I was going to read that review and be like, no, I must buy another processor.
The blood, I understand.
That'll sell blood.
But again, I would say, I'm going to scroll through here and look, like if you had a Ryzen 5 1400, mm-hmm. which is a 4-core, 8-thread, still a good processor, that handbrake encoding was 738 seconds. And with this new processor, it drops to 306. Right. So now you're talking about actually an impressive upgrade path without having to replace your memory, without having to replace your motherboard. Drop in, you know, the cooler you're using before is probably going to be good enough as long as you bought a kind of a standard kind of DIY consumer class part. Pretty nice.
I'll take it. Speaking of second generation Ryzen processors and their performance, Jeremy wrote a quick wrap up on this one. Ryzen 2 can almost hit 6 gigahertz. Now, this is not you or me overclocking, right? This is the 4.3 gigahertz part, the Ryzen 7 2700X. But with liquid nitrogen, years of experience, who knows how many lost fingernails due to liquid nitrogen exposure. But the Ryzen 7 2700X went all the way up from 4.3 gigahertz to 5.884 gigahertz. And the 4.2 gigahertz Ryzen 5 2600X went all the way up to 5.882 gigahertz. All the cores were running. Not all the cores were running at that speed, but all the cores were running. So, you know, the Inquirer's got some information on that if you want to get deeper on it. But I think that the suggestion, if you will, is that, you know, overclocking is certainly an opportunity to gain additional performance on this. And I would assume that these are very carefully sorted parts and they, you know, did a little bin sorting and see which processors were more amenable than others to turning things up high. But, you know, I thought that was pretty impressive, getting up to a biscuit under 6 gigahertz. Yeah. So, and again, you know, this is not any human normal everyday thing to do unless you, I mean, I have a liquid nitrogen Dewar in my garage because I found one at a garage sale and I've always wanted one because, you know, liquid nitrogen ice cream and occasionally freezing parts. But this is not even remotely practical. However, you know, if you throw a particular, you know, I will be curious to see where people end up clocking these at, because A, the stock cooler is good. B, there's improvement possibilities with liquid cooling. People haven't started ripping lids off and putting liquid coolers on them yet. But overclocking has some possibilities. Alan's version of a quick look is in-depth testing that would put most full reviews to shame, but he took a quick look at AMD Ryzen's X470E NVMe storage performance. From your review of the 2700, I am not feeling that you thought the X470 was a huge deal. For example, along with not being ready to upgrade my CPU, I don't feel a desperate need to upgrade my motherboard at this point. You know, the nice thing is like all the M.2 ports in these are direct connected to the CPU. Alan points out, quote, this should be the case for most systems since the AMD chipset only has a PCIe 2x4 link, which would cut most NVMe SSD bandwidth in half if it passed through it. Quote, the difference on AMD is that installing the RAID Expert software also installs a bottom driver, which replaces the Windows NVMe driver, while Intel's RST platform handles this process more in the chipset hardware, but is limited to PCIe 3x4 DMI bandwidth. You know, how was the performance? Was he enthusiastic about this, or?
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting because this was a feature that was previously kind of limited to Threadripper platforms. Sure. It appears that all of the X470 boards will support this, or almost all of them. And actually, it looks like some of the X370 boards will support it now, as long as they have the most recent AGESA, you know, BIOS structure update from AMD, if the board partners integrated that correctly. So this is something that people have kind of been asking for. Not all boards have two M.2 slots on them, of course, to do NVMe RAID. In general, it kind of looked like because the SSDs were direct connected, the straight line performance was actually quite a bit higher than what you get out of the Intel configuration. Really? On mainstream platforms, because they have to go through chipset. The downside is because of the integration method that AMD uses, the IOPS are lower, right? The low Q depth IOPS were a little bit lower on the NVMe RAID of the AMD platform. So we didn't have a whole lot of time to spend with it, but we got some of these early numbers to look at. So there's definitely a trade-off between the way Intel has integrated it and the way AMD has integrated it. And it's pretty clear that this was added. It's definitely added after the fact, after the idea came to AMD to do this. Whereas at Intel, it was kind of something that has been built up over a couple of generations and integrated in. So just a little bit better support. I would expect when we actually do see the next, you know, storage controller integration onto a new chipset, as opposed to just kind of revisions like we're seeing with the X470, that we may see improvements in this going forward. But it's definitely an impressive. It's an impressive add-on to have for your system.
Nothing wrong with that.
Then the Store MI, I don't know if we want to... The Store MI stuff is really interesting. I think we talked about this before. It's like a tiering caching system. It's kind of odd. But potentially really, really interesting and really powerful. We had tested it and used it for a little bit. AMD came back to us and said, actually, we have a couple of big changes coming to it. We want you to hold off on evaluating it, because they're going to change some of the performance and some of the interface and the usability sides of it, which are some feedback we gave them in terms of it not being a fantastic experience using it. But the idea is simple. You know, you tie an SSD up to 256 gigs into a hard drive, you know, like if you've got a 4 terabyte, 8 terabyte hard drive, whatever it is, it sees them as one device. You install OS to it as one device, or you can install this. You can do this after you've installed the operating system to your hard drive, add the SSD in after the fact, boom, set it up, and it kind of intelligently moves the data you're more often using to the SSD. You know, similar type of idea that we've seen in other caching systems, but with some more flexibility. So hopefully we'll be able to dive into that in the next week or two.
Nothing wrong with that. You know what else is kind of nice? Well, we're talking about things that have nothing wrong with them. This episode of This Week Computer Hardware brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Ryan, do you have any... you can go to Ring's Twitter feed to get clips of the Ring Video Doorbell in action. You know, really simple. What's on the other side of that door? You know, Ring's mission, they're trying to make neighborhoods safer. Hope you can look at it right now. Something's going on. I think you've got the wrong address. Wait for it. Oh, okay. Thank you. Now, that could have been somebody who was legitimately at the wrong address. It could have been somebody who was looking for a house that did not have anybody answering the door. And then, boom, around back, kicking the door, scuffle for some easily fenceable objects, and away they go. You know, Ring wants to make neighborhoods safer. And the Ring Video Doorbell lets you see and speak to intruders or neighbors on your smartphone from anywhere. You can share video clips with your neighbors using the Ring app. Hey, have you seen this guy? Is he hitting all our doors or just mine? And, you know, it's pretty nice, right? They got the floodlight and spotlight cam. So you can build a whole ring of security around your entire property. I mean, Ryan, are you edging? Are you thinking about the floodlight cam, that whole motion activated camera and floodlights?
I definitely have a place for it in on the front of the garage, and we could probably use them at the office here for sure.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, right? High visibility floodlights, HD video, two-way audio. Let's know the moment anybody steps on your property. You can see and speak to visitors, even set off an alarm right from your phone. When things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. We had one of the cats, we have what we refer to as the garden cat, knocked over a ladder that one of my boys had left precariously leaning up against the garage, which led to a moment of, you know, what was that, panic. And it would have been nice to be able to pick up my phone and open the app and have the backyard flooded with light, therefore probably causing the cat to panic even farther away from our backyard. But to actually see, like, oh, there's nobody back there. It's nice, right? Ring floodlight cams, they offer the ultimate home security. Thieves just can't hide with Ring. Monitor every corner of your property with a Ring of security kit. It includes a Ring video doorbell, your choice of either one, two, or three floodlight cams, so you can basically cover the whole scene. Connect your Ring video doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs for added convenience, monitoring, and security. Oh, that's Ryan. I'll let Ryan into the house and unlock the door. Stop crime before it happens and make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Save up to $150 on a Ring of security kit at ring.com/twitch. That's ring.com/TWICH. $150 off when you go to ring.com/twitch. We want to thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Speaking of processors and performance, the Intel Nook 7i7D and HE, which rolls off the tongue, so we'll call it Dawson Canyon, and I'll try not to call it Dawson's Creek review. Quad-core mobile hits the desktop. Ken's got the write-up on this one. You know, everybody's kind of paying attention to the Hades Canyon Nook. I have one friend that bought at least two of them. He was so thrilled at the performance that was available in that. The basic, you know, 4-inch by 4-inch Nook design is not dead, as Ken notes. How was he feeling about the performance and the value? Because Simply Nook, $595, two HDMI 2.8 ports, four USB 3.0 ports, wireless AC, 8265 vPro. There's a M.2 SATA or PCIe drive slot. There's a 5.25-inch drive slot, which I love. Excuse me, a 2.5-inch drive slot. I remain numerically dyslexic. 2.5-inch. Mobile drive, not desktop drive, pair of SO DIMM slots, DDR4, and that Core i7-8650U, the Kaby Lake refresh, which is a nice performer and a fairly power-sipping performer for something that'll be constantly plugged into the wall. Performance, yep. Good? Was he pleased? Because the specs look great.
Yeah, the performance on it is good. This is a Kaby Lake refresh part, quad-core, 8-thread, standard kind of HD 620 integrated graphics, I think. It has spot for NVMe SSDs. I think we configured with like 32 gigs of RAM. It's a heck of a machine. So performance-wise, no complaints, especially for something in this form factor. Not quite up to snuff as the, you know, in terms of gaming or graphics performance, like that Hades Canyon Nook that we talked about previously. But this is a much smaller and less expensive device as well. In terms of value, the thing about Nooks is they've never been cheap, right? They've never been, you know, positioned as value products in any case. They're kind of, I don't know if I call them flagship or if I'd call them something else, but they're basically, Intel creates these, you know, Gigabyte has their Brick series, Dell has small form factor devices, HP has small form factor devices. They don't quite exactly maybe match the 4x4 structure that the Nook does. Pricing you're looking at, I think, let's see, depending on your configuration. So as we configured it, about $1,000, right?
Whoa.
So that's with 32 gigs of memory. Memory is very expensive these days. And a 240 gig SanDisk SSD, the 2.5-inch drive.
That's SATA. That's $200 in memory? $300 in memory?
I think it's maybe more than that. Yeah, 32. You know, you drop that down to 16 gigs. you're looking at about $750 range for that configuration, right? Which is, again, it's still pricey up there for what you're getting. You're essentially getting the insides of a high-end thin and light notebook without the, you know, display and keyboard and all that stuff that goes with it. There is no Thunderbolt on this, which is a little bit of a letdown. There are no quad-core hyper-threaded Nooks that have Thunderbolt other than the Hades Canyon that I'm aware of. There's one called Baby Canyon that's out now, which is based on 7th gen and has Thunderbolt, but that's only a 2-core 4-thread part. So we didn't really, you know, find a whole lot of need to kind of compare that. I think I would like to see Thunderbolt come back to these devices in more of a broader range of options. So maybe we'll see that when we get to Coffee Lake or Cannon Lake or whatever is coming down the road next from Intel in that space. But these are still really interesting devices. They're really well built. They have expandability. They have other capabilities. But it's not a despite its appearance, maybe that it might be a budget friendly option for, you know, mom or dad or grandma or whatever. It's really not. It's a pretty high performance part.
And I will point out, I've 2 16-gigabyte. DDR4 SODIMMs are running between $320 to $360, depending on whether you're looking at Corsair or a more generic brand. So call it $350 in memory inside of that build. So that's a pretty... Why did he go with 32 gigs? What was he looking to do with that?
I don't know, to be fair. I don't know. Just what we had around, probably.
Western Digital's Black NVMe and SanDisk Extreme Pro M.2 NVMe 3D 1 TB SSD review. Alan is he's not a taciturn man. He's not the kind of guy who he will talk as long as you want him to talk. He is, however, stingy with praise, and I say that in a complimentary fashion because a lot of reviewers out there, it's like an amazing, it's disruptive, changes the industry, when it's really not that big a deal. But he flat out called the WD Black NVMe and SanDisk Extreme Pro M.2 NVMe outstanding, which is a big deal in Alan's world. You know, the packaging is no frills. You know, they're NVMe, you know, M.2 NVMe drives, right? You know, they've got stickers on them. As you scroll down, not much to the packaging, which I'm a big fan of because I'd rather, quite frankly, spend... I want to spend the money on the hardware, not on the fancy box. But these are looking really good in terms of the performance. The WD Black and SanDisk Extreme Pro dominating in sequential writes, significantly higher than everything else, including a 960 Evo and even a 960 Pro. That's a big deal.
Yeah, we haven't really seen competitors for 960 Pro in the NVMe space. You know, there's stuff that's pretty good. There's stuff that's reasonable and it may be good enough and better priced than that. This is, you know, competing strongly in performance characteristics.
I mean, we're talking like for sequential writes, we're talking like a 0.5 gigabyte per second. You know, jumping from just under 2,000 megabytes per second to just over 2,500 megabytes per second. That's huge. That's huge. You know, burst 128 kilobyte sequential reads. Samsung still got the win at that. But Western Digital, the SanDisk and Western Digital parts are very competitive with everybody else out there. You know, in terms of, you know, burst 4K random write, you know, the IOPS and all these are looking really, really good. You know, quote, it's hard to tell with the light blue Western Digital line falling directly behind the orange SanDisk line, but both products are extremely strong here. The Intel SSD 750 was a longtime winner in this area, but these two products might have it beat. And, you know, so you keep reading, you get the full information on that, and you can do that by heading over to PCPer.com. Any faults with these? There were some caching inconsistencies he noted during cache testing. Was that something we should be worried about or just something?
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he saw them. They're repeatable, but they didn't seem to affect any of the performance metrics that showed, you know, that were looking towards real world use cases. Right. So in all the numbers you saw, like those metrics, the write speeds and stuff you were quoting, those all came while those caching inconsistencies were happening in the background. So while they existed and you can read about what impact they may have, it doesn't seem to really be a detriment to the drive in and of itself, which is good. And in Western Digital / SanDisk has a really, really interesting competitive part on their hands.
I was going to say, and part of what's so amazing about this is $450 for a 1 terabyte NVMe drive. To put that into perspective, the Samsung 960 Pro, which it handily beats in terms of sequential writes, but is a little bit behind in some of the other benchmarks, that's $615. So you're looking at 45 cents a gigabyte, approximately 25% less, more than 25, maybe 26% less than the 960 Pro series. That's a big deal. And congratulations to Western Digital and SanDisk. It's not like SanDisk doesn't know memory, but this is a pretty fascinating part from them, and something I covet. As I have one machine, my primary desktop machine is 1 terabyte SSD in it, and my secondary desktop machine is a 250 gigabyte SSD. Boy, I'm ready to put a 1 terabyte SSD in that second machine because it's just so nice to have all that data and your applications all nearby. Intel technical documentation outs 8-core Coffee Lake S processor, the first of several accidental reveals we'll be talking about in this episode. 8 CPU cores, 2 integrated GPU cores. I mean, what's the story on this one?
Essentially, this was an Intel technical documentation that probably shouldn't have been out there that indicates that we will see those 8-core Coffee Lake S processors. And in one instance, they list it in conjunction with the Coffee Lake S 6-core parts, which is what the 8700K is. This is an indicator that, at the very least, Intel has finalized the validation for an 8-core version of these processors to be released. We were just talking about the Ryzen 7 2700X and how it really, really pushed the multi-threaded performance advantage that it has over Intel, because Intel's is a 6-core part. You got a 25% core deficit. Intel could make up for that, maybe take the leads back, the advantages back in those spaces by releasing an 8-core part. What would be interesting is, what chipsets will it run on? What motherboards will it run on? Will it support the Z370 that's out there now that was really launched only for the 8700K, essentially? Or will it need this new Z390 chipset that's been rumored out for a long time? And then also, what would they price something like that at? The 8700K currently sells for about $349 in the range, $20-$30 within the range of the 2700X from AMD. So now... Would Intel try to match that price point? Would they say, actually, no, look, we have confidence in our parts. We're going to make it $399 or $429 or whatever it's going to be, and be able to take some of that performance crown back. But these informations kind of confirm that it is a thing. It doesn't confirm that they're going to release it. There are many instances where products like this are validated and then not released to the market because of some, product decision, right? Oh, we don't want to do that because we're going to cut into this market, or we have this product that's coming 3 months later and we don't want to, release a product that's going to tick people off that way. So still a lot to be learned, I guess, but pretty interesting stuff.
Pretty interesting stuff. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans. Getting a mortgage sucks. It's painful. It's scary. Spousal arguments. Friends argue. Parents and children argue. Are we putting enough down? What should we do? Can we get this? Can we afford this? Who should we go with? It's a mess. And, I've never felt that the whole mortgaging process was designed to make life easier for anybody. I could be wrong, but this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans. And it's really simple. Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage because getting a mortgage was so 20th century, so old school, so awful. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan, because it's simple, so you can fully understand all the details. All the information is available on your computer. Quicken Loans is applying their core skills of looking at all the numbers and processing them for you to make life easier, so you can fully understand all the details, be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. What happens if a point here, a point there, the percentage rate, what's this mean? It's convenient, right? You know, their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. No dealing with, oh, goodness, shipping information around for different, my mom still weeps about carrying piles of paper around back in the day. Rocket Mortgage, powerful, able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Doesn't matter if it's your first home or your 10th. They're going to be able to run the numbers for you based on your incomes, your assets, your credit. Rocket Mortgage can analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. So when you sign, digital or otherwise, on the dotted line, you can feel comfortable. It doesn't have to be fear. It can be confidence. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply. Understand fully. Mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. That's rocketmortgage.com/TWIT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support. Good stuff, people. Nothing wrong with making things less painful. Speaking of less painful, or speaking of Apple, which may or may not be less painful, depending on your point of view on that whole scene. So we are waiting for the big announcement, June 4th, the big reveal of what we presume is going to be the next generation phones, possibly some tablets. Mac Rumors says Apple registers several new unreleased iPhone models in Eurasia ahead of WWDC. It was an EEC filing published on Tuesday. Quote, satisfies Russia's requirement for companies to register all products containing encryption and or cryptographic tools. So two new models of iPad, which, quote, proved to be the Wi-Fi and cellular versions of Apple's 9.7-inch iPad. That was unveiled on March 27th. And so there's a decent chance, Mac Rumors writes, the new model numbers identify iPhones tipped for a May or June launch, end quote. You know, this is several new models of MacBook were registered with the EEC May of last year. Those laptops were announced at WWDC 2017. So they're building their case that, you know, these new numbers probably represent new iPhones. And what we're expecting is three flagship phones in 2018. Quote, two OLED models measuring it at 5.8 and 6.5 inches and a 6.1 inch lower cost LCD models. And so those will probably be announced in June, shipping in September. But apparently the big rumor is that there's going to be a new entry-level smartphone, something similar to the iPhone SE that'll have wireless charging and be released this summer. There hasn't been a really big refresh or update to the iPhone SE since March 2016, outside of some storage updates on that one. But we'll see. We'll see. June 4th is the beginning of the Worldwide Developers Conference, and we expect to hear more from the Apple at the conference. And I tweeted about this earlier after reading the article, because as my friends over at Hack 5 say, trust your techno lust. And my techno lust is fully armed, locked, and loaded for Western Digital's UltraStar DC-HC530. It's a TDMR 14-terabyte hard disk drive. I know this is an enterprise drive. This is for data centers. This is not to throw in my NAS. My NAS would probably pee itself in fear if I stuffed it with eight of these things in it, if a NAS can pee itself in fear. But 14-terabyte drives. Not MAMR, couples PMR with TDMR, two-dimensional magnetic recording. But you're talking about 900 gigabits per square inch, which is just crazy. And, you know, this is a little bit different from the Helium, the HelioSeal, the HDST UltraStar lineups. Instead of being like the HE8, HE10, we have the DC-HC530. Five-year warranty.
Of course.
14 terabytes.
Look at the size of that buffer, 512 megs of memory on this hard drive, essentially. And so control transfer rates of 267 megabytes per second. So it's definitely faster on the inside there. It's a start of disk than previous drives. That obviously that slows down as you move outward on the disk. But yes, you're right. This is not something that's going to end up in your machine, but we've kind of seen this cadence that maybe by the end of this year, this means we'll see 14 terabyte drives in, you know, WD Red or WD Gold, right. Channels, for example.
It would be nice. I mean, because the current WD Red NAS hard drives top out at a mere 10 terabytes.
Jeez.
We modest 10 terabytes.
In a side note, like hard drive prices, it was interesting because we were talking about how expensive SSDs are. But generally, when you're buying an SSD, you're only buying one, right? So if you're buying a one terabyte, you know, NVMe SSD, it's $450 to $500 for the drive. And I go, oh my gosh, that's a lot of money. Yeah, but hard drives are so cheap. But we were filling a six bay NAS with six 12 terabyte drives, and I think our total bill was like $2,200 or something like that for hard drives. And I was just like, yeah, like I understand the math, but it doesn't matter how many drives there are. Yeah, exactly. Like for some reason, you shouldn't be paying $2,200 for hard drives today. That's crazy. Yes, I understand that that's, you know, 48 terabytes of usable array with RAID 6 working, but still. That still seems like I was, kind of taken aback.
Hard drive should cost nothing.
Exactly. Well,
it's also, I mean, this is, you know, it's, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because if you start digging through Amazon, you search for, WD Reds, the Amazon choice is the 4 terabyte NAS drive, $125 for a 4 terabyte WD Red. 8 terabyte WD Red, which doubles your capacity, is $304. So it's a little bit more expensive in terms of cost per gigabyte. A 1 terabyte is $72. So the cost per gigabyte, I think, drops down by a fairly big chunk between 1 terabyte and 4 terabyte, as in really don't buy a 1 terabyte drive if you don't have to. But it's crazy. Like WD Red Pro 6 terabyte drives, $252. The 8 terabytes, $304. And then of course the Seagate Iron Wolf, not red drives, but with red on their labels, start showing up in there. The 10 terabyte drives are a little bit harder to find than I would like, but I can't really afford them anyway, even at the MSRP at $380, because, yeah, that would be like your bill. Let's see, 380 times 8 equals, yeah, that would be $3,000 with drives for my NAS and the cost of a divorce. But, you know, those 4 terabyte drives would be a pretty healthy step up for me. And it's 125 times 8 equals $1,000. Probably 8 of those sitting around in the corner of the, the corner of your space, the office space, if I snuffle around hard enough. But yeah, those 14 terabyte drives, I shudder to think of what those cost. But they're also buying in much larger bulk than we are. Toshiba refreshed their HDD brand, their hard disk drive branding. And oddly enough, speaking of Seagate's Iron Wolf drives, introduces surveillance and video streaming models because everybody wants to kind of catch back up. Not that it's that dramatic, but everybody's gunning for Western Digital. Western Digital did this whole segmentation of drives for use that has been really, really valuable. And, it's kind of funny. So there's a green Toshiba that's for surveillance, a blue Toshiba for video streaming, a brown Toshiba for NAS, the gray Toshiba for performance, the red Toshiba for PC desk, and the tiny red Toshiba for PC mobile. Capacities aren't as impressive, but they like the video streaming drives. These are 3.5-inch drives, 500 gigabytes up to 3 terabytes. The surveillance drives are 4 gigabytes to 10 terabytes. You're looking at a pretty modest price. 3 terabytes video streaming drive is $90. The S300 surveillance drives are topping out at 10 terabytes for $350, which makes them a little bit more affordable than the options from Western Digital. But as Alan notes, the annual workload rating troubles him a bit. Quote, especially for the S300, that model is meant for use in an array which must be initialized, eating one full drive write, possibly migrated, eating another full drive capacity worth of access, and with some RAID controllers periodically scrubbing the data to verify integrity, a large array of 10 terabyte hard disk drives with periodic array scrubbing and integrity checking scheduled every 2 to 3 weeks will technically run these parts past the rated workload. Backing off the monthly checks will get you just under the limit, provided your actual video workload does not push you over. So Make sure your cost savings does not cost your savings. Caveat emptor. So
indeed.
Oh my goodness. We did the barbecue episode on the tech thing this week, although we went kind of crazy. We talked about over-the-air antennas last week, and then this week, as the big thing we got was, well, what about ATSC 3.0? Well, I need a new antenna. And fortunately, ATSC 3.0, which is the next generation broadcast spec, is really not going to be available to most of everyone or anyone until 2019 or 2020. It's just rolling out. TVs don't exist until 2019. The tuners don't exist. The technology is really interesting. But if y'all want to, you know, Ryan and I to talk about that, by all means, tweet at Ryan Schroud or at Patrick Norton, beg us, plead with us, or just politely ask, would you talk about ATSC 3.0? Although I think I pretty much beat that horse to death on tech thing this week. But we talked about, you know, the portable growler, a superior cooler. Shannon has a grill bot, a robotic automated grill scrubber.
And, Very interested to see that. Yeah,
that's the Trail Keg pressurized growler. If you like the beer from the local place that sells the growler, that's the way to keep it from going flat in 24 hours. And my favorite digital meat thermometers and ATSC 3.0. So, nice. Anything you can tease about what's coming up at PC Per, or is it still pretty stealthy at this point?
We'll have some follow-ups on the 2700 and 2600 from Ryzen. I believe Maury has a couple of motherboards in his hands, X470 motherboards, to take a look at. I think we'll have another review up next week, or a new review up of the Corsair K63, which is the lap board. Kind of, can you use a keyboard and a mouse while sitting on the couch? Type of device, and I'm very interested to see what the review comes out with. So
it always seems to be harder than it sounds like, and so many of the devices do things like, well, as long as you don't mind having your keyboard over here and your mouse over here, which is fine if you're gaming, but problematic for everything else.
Yep,
that might just be my lap. Maybe my lap isn't wide enough. PCPer.com is a place to find more. Ryan Schroud and the whole crew at PC Perspective, who have some of the finest hardware testing in the land. You can find me over at techthing.com. Or if you're into home theater and audio, please join me and Robert Heron at avxl.com. And as always, you can tweet at Ryan Schroud, at Patrick Norton, or, well, to anyone else you want to tweet to. But if you want us to answer your questions, stick to at Ryan Schroud and at Patrick Norton. And you can find all of our older episodes and information on how to subscribe at twit.tv/Twitch. That's twit.tv/TWICH. Thank you, as always, to our sponsors, and a big special thanks to each and every one of you, because without you, there's not a whole lot of point in recording this conversation. Ryan and I could just have it. Kevin could, our producer, could have his day back. Burke wouldn't be able to mock us, but that's okay. But thanks for being here. We do this for you. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schroud.
Catch you next week on Twitch.